This episode is brought to you by Chiefs on Broadway. There's a different way to experience live music in Nashville. Eric Church's Chiefs on Broadway is home to the Neon Steeple, an intimate live music venue in the heart of downtown Nashville, where artists and songwriters take the stage for up-close, unforgettable shows. From stripped-down sets to surprise guests, no two nights are the same. Check out the Neon Steeple lineup and get your tickets now at chiefsonbroadway.com. It's June. Happy June. We believe there's no time quite like summer to enjoy some country music. BGS is leaning into all things quality country with our sister site, Good Country. This month's edition of Good Country highlights Artist of the Month, Jody Messina, and we have sit-downs with Braxton Keith, the Broody Brothers, and Ashley McBride. Dive in at thebluegrasssituation.com/goodcountry, and thank you for being part of the BGS and Good Country communities.
Hi, and welcome to The Working Songwriter, the show where today's best songwriters come to talk shop. I'm your host, Joe Pug. Each episode here, we host a distinguished guest, and we ask them to go deep on their inspiration, on their process, on the general ups and downs of making a life in music. So, whether you're a grizzled veteran attempting to write an entire album using only the Mixolydian scale, or else a scrappy upstart, attempting to scrub your songs of any musical nuance beyond a seventh chord, this is your show, because ultimately, it is what every writer seeks most, an ironclad excuse to put off actually writing. Hey everyone, it's the third Friday of April 2026, and I thank you for joining us. This week's show is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. I'm old enough to remember when you had to pay somebody called a web developer to get a website made. It would always be some guy named Buford who drove a Hummer H2 that he got from a police auction and who was always trying to sell you bootleg mixtapes with a gratuitous amount of Outkast songs on them. And old Buford would charge you about $1,000 for a website that would be obsolete in 6 months. But it's the future now. You guys, that's not how it works anymore. We're allowed to have nice things now. One of those nice things is Bandzoogle. For over 20 years, Bandzoogle has made it easy to build a stunning website and online store for your music. Now they've added a brand new EPK plan so that musicians can create a professional single-page electronic press kit in minutes. Everything you need is already built in. Music players, images, text bio, video embeds, a gig calendar, press quotes, and access to Bandzoogle's award-winning support team 7 days a week. The new EPK plan starts at just $6.95 per month, and the Working Songwriter podcast listeners can go to Bandzoogle.com to try it for free for 30 days. Then use the promo code TWSEPK to get 10% off the first year of any new EPK plan subscription. That's Bandzoogle.com, promo code TWSEPK when you sign up for a new EPK plan. Finally, if you enjoy this podcast, if you'd like to help it remain a viable endeavor for me, here's a couple things that you could do to help. First and foremost, you could become a subscriber to The Vault. What is The Vault? The Vault is a private, members-only section of my website that hosts every single episode of The Working Songwriter ever recorded. Additionally, The Vault has every single album I've ever recorded. Not all of them are on Spotify. There's also an archive of the iconic Enthusiast Digest newsletter there. Go to joepugmusic.com/vault. Become a subscriber today. It's $5 a month. And for your generosity there, you also get access to all of that content. So thank you to everyone who has subscribed over there. If you're not in a place where you can contribute in that way, I totally understand. But there's still a couple ways that you could help us out for free. First, you could leave us a rating in the iTunes store. Or second, you could simply tell a friend about the show. Spread the word about the show. The simple math on those two things is that they will help me much more than they will be a pain in the ass for you. Okay, I'll end all the harassment there. I hope that you enjoy this week's episode. guest this week hails from Augusta, Georgia, but has made his professional bones in Music City, USA. Charles Kelly was one of the founding members of Lady Antebellum, now known as Lady A, and is one of the group's principal songwriters. Their crossover hit, Need You Now, became one of the defining songs of the 2010s. That group has sold over 18 million albums, won 7 Grammy Awards, and their songs have been streamed over 5 billion, with a B, times. Along the way, Charles has also released a pair of solo albums, including last year's Song for a New Moon. He's recorded for Capitol Records Nashville and Big Machine. He's toured with Luke Bryan, Tim McGraw, Keith Urban, and many others. He's appeared on The Tonight Show and The Late Show with David Letterman. Rolling Stone has said that Lady A's vocal harmonies helped redefine country radio in the 2010s, and Billboard calls them one of Nashville's most successful songwriting teams. I got a chance to catch up with Charles a few months ago to hear about his musical journey so far. Charles Kelly of Lady A, of your own solo work, of many different musical endeavors, thanks so much for being a part of the Working Songwriter podcast. You know, it sounds like the house that you grew up in with your two brothers, music was not exactly an optional endeavor.
Yeah.
You got started pretty early.
Yeah, it was something we got into pretty early. My oldest brother, he was about 10 years older than Josh and I, and he brought home a guitar one summer from college. And, you know, he really never became that proficient in it, my oldest brother. But then Josh picked it up, and Josh became a virtuoso of guitar and many instruments, but yeah, he did that, and then I was like, well, I guess I need to find an instrument, so I started playing drums and you know, started singing, and Josh and I found a couple friends in, you know, around Augusta and started a band. So been playing in cover bands since I was about 11 years old, 12 years old, I think.
That's a very brotherly dynamic. We're making that, little brother play range. Drums. That's and, it. We need a drummer.
Just,
and he's
you
it.
Know. Been loving it ever since.
Yeah, man. So, and you guys would even form a band at that age. You even met one of your musical longtime collaborators, Dave Haywood, at that time. What kind of music were you guys into and listening to at that time?
Everything, man. I think you know, that's a reason that you hear so many influences on Lady A, and obviously, you know, why there's so many influences on this project as well. But I, you know, grew up listening to anything from Bryan Adams to Dave Matthews to Led Zeppelin, you know, Nirvana, all of it. I mean, really, that was, I remember the first few records that I can remember vividly, like being just obsessed with and moved by, was Nirvana, Nevermind, and then Fleetwood Mac, Rumors. And it was like at the same time, like those two records just kind of blew me away. And so just, you know, just have always soaked up anything and everything that I loved at the time. You know, it could have been Boyz II Men, and I just loved everything. And so, you know, I think it couldn't help but eventually all meld together in my, you know, influences.
90s were a great time for that, too. You know, that Nirvana Nevermind record, it would be a hit if it came out today. The melodies are just
I agree. I tell people all the time, I say, you know, it must be maybe not quite as big of a global impact as the Beatles had, but for my generation, I remember a visceral, like, reaction, like, obsessive, and just, like, I've never felt or heard anything like this when I heard that record. You know, especially Smells Like Teen Spirit, it just made me want to, like, literally jump out of my body. And so... records like that just really, you know, I can, they timestamp certain points in my life, you know.
So you got started very early, but then you didn't go right into music. You know, you went to school, you got a degree. I think you even spent some time working for your oldest brother, construction and stuff like that. When did you decide to yourself, hey man, actually I'm going to give this a go. I'm going to go for it.
Yeah, that first year I got out of Georgia and working in the real world, I realized, I was like, gosh, this is just, you know, again, I mean, I was only 23, but I'd already, like, could see the trajectory of my life heading somewhere that I just knew that wasn't going to make me happy. And so, you know, I was really fortunate that my brother Josh Kelly had he had gotten a record deal out of college, and he had moved to LA and you know, had some good success. And when he had moved to Nashville, it was like this perfect storm where I was coming up on about a year of, you know, working, and I just was like, man, I'm so unhappy. I can already see where this is going. And he said, man, move to Nashville. You got nothing to lose. And so I think if it wasn't for my brother and actually seeing that it was a possibility to have success in the music business, because, you know, growing up, I was like, I loved playing music, but I don't think I ever really thought it was a job, you know? And right. So, you know, to me, I think seeing him having, you know, gone down that road and been bold enough, it gave me, you know, a little bit of confidence to try it.
What was the Nashville that you found on the ground when you got there around 2005, 2006? These days, I mean, if you want to do any kind of music, you can do it in Nashville. It's just, it's like that now. What was it like in 2005 when you got there? Was it still just a predominantly, you know, big country music town, or was it already shifting into the direction that it would go now?
I mean, it was definitely dominated by country. I mean, you did have some bands like Kings of Leon, you know, bubbling under the surface, and some different bands like that. But it was definitely country. And, you know, and honestly, when I first moved to town, I didn't know if I was going to be a songwriter. I was still kind of chasing much more of a pop sound. And when I met Hillary and we started writing songs together, it really brought out much more of this warm, you know, kind of pop country feel to it. And so we, you know, we went down that direction. I've just always loved, you know, all of it. I was just as much influenced by, you know, for me, my influences in the country genre are more like George Strait, Tim McGraw, Garth Brooks, you know, so it wasn't a stretch to pull from those guys, which I've always considered to, you know, especially the Tim McGraws of the world, you know, are pulling just as much from Southern rock and, you know, stuff like that as they are from traditional country. And so, you know, I feel like with my voice, which was much more of a Southern rock kind of Bob Seger type of feel, you know, matching up with Hillary, which is much more of a, you know, a pure country voice, it did create kind of a cool pop Southern rock country band, you know. And so that's where that went. But to me, really, it always, my main focus was just writing songs. And I remember kind of even passing around some of my songs to some people that my brother Josh, you know, got me in the room with, and they were like, there's a lot of potential here, you need to start writing with some of these great writers in town. I remember they would spit off these names, which now, you know, I know is like the big writers in town, but I remember they're like, you need to get in the room with Wendell Mobley, or, you know, or this, or Victoria Shaw. And I was like, who are those people? You know, I didn't know anything about these songwriters. And,
well,
and
maybe
now,
it's good that you were naive to who they were, because otherwise you would have been maybe too nervous to step in the damn room, you know?
Well, dude, I could tell you a story specifically. When we first started touring as a band, you know, I think it was probably our fourth or fifth show at a little place called Third and Lindsay here in town. And, you know, I didn't realize it, but by the fourth or fifth show, we had about two or three different label heads in there. We had Joe Galante and, you know, all these big people, Paul Worley, who we ended up working with on the record, you know, were in that room. And I think if I had known that, I would have been super nervous, but I didn't know who these guys were. So, you know, I think everything just kind of, you know, kind of showed itself, and everything happened for the right reason. But it was, but it's funny when I, you know, for me, I get way more starstruck when I see a great songwriter in town, you know, that like just has had these world class, you know, types of songs, you know, than anybody else, you know, like Dean Dillon. Get in a room with Dean Dillon, you're just like, oh my gosh, this is like the guy.
So when you were getting in the room with some of those more, you know, seasoned and veteran songwriters who had been through the ringer already themselves, what was your first impressions of it? I mean, were they just running circles around you and you were trying to keep above water, or how did it work?
It was a little bit of both, where I feel like I was bringing in some different cool melodic outside of the genre ideas. But I think the most thing that impressed me with them was just how they always knew how to get back to the hook. I think that was something early on. You know, I might have a hook, but then I would have lyrics that didn't really, you know, everything needs to lead back to that hook at some point, you know, and just the way that they're able to turn a phrase and make, you know, make something super creative and out of, you know, maybe the simplest lyric, you know, and But I do think there's a certain structure that you know, that even as I've written more, that you just know. It's like you naturally know how to like create it and get back to that thing. But there is this certain level of innocence when you don't know how to write a hit song that makes you go to places that once you know how to write a hit song that you can't go back to. And I feel like that's why there was some interesting, our first record. I mean, if you listen to our first single, Love Don't Live Here, I mean, it's a minute and a half before it even gets to the chorus. It's two full verses before it gets to the chorus. Then it has a half verse and then a chorus and an outro. So it doesn't have a bridge. It doesn't even have three choruses. I would never do that now, but it feels right. It just feels right. So I think sometimes you have to get out of your way too. So there's this beautiful balance. And that's why I love co-writing. That's why I love writing with new artists too, because like they're coming in with a little more of this fresh, naive, beautiful, you know, I don't know how to say it. Just the waters haven't been too muddied up yet. You know, it's like they're coming with fresh ideas, and then I'm there to help kind of like structure it, pull out the good bits, and get rid of the ones that don't make sense. And I think that's the beauty of co-writing, you know. But there's no way I could have become the songwriter I am today without being in the room with Josh Keir, you know, without being in the room with Tom Douglas. I mean, those guys are at the top of the list, you know. I mean, Hillary Lindsay, she's just always has the answer. I think that's one of those things. When I write songs like by myself, I feel like I can get a song to about 75-80%, but I always get stuck, and I feel like those guys never get stuck.
It sounds like your graduate school, except you didn't have to take out an $80,000 loan.
I don't know. Our first year on the road, not many people realize, you know, we were like opening up for these big artists and stuff, and we're getting
maybe
$2,000 for the show, and it's costing us about $6,000 in buses and things. And I was like, I think we're in the hole about $200,000 our first year out.
Well, it worked out. You know, it's funny hearing you talk about that first single and not getting to the chorus a minute and a half in. I was just listening to Don't Stop Believing the other day. My kids wanted to hear it in the back of the car.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that refrain doesn't come in until the end of the song. It's 3 minutes before refrain that we all know. And you wouldn't even think of that. Right.
Not at all.
It
and that's blew my mind.
Yeah. It, I told my wife that and she didn't believe me. I had to play it for her and say, look, it didn't make that time. Till 3 minutes in. Man, that is, so when did things, so you meet Hillary, Dave becomes involved as well. When did you know that you had something there that might be more than the sum of its parts? And how did the project sort of take off?
Well, you know, we wrote the first two songs we wrote ended up being on that first record and are still, like, I think some of the best songs I've ever been a part of. A song called Can't Take My Eyes Off You. And the other one was, what was the other one? All I'd Ever Need. And it was just like, wow, there's something here. But it wasn't until we had Love Don't Live Here that I remember I called up Hillary and I said, we have something. We have something going. And I said, I've got this crazy idea. Because in the beginning, I think we were just writing for maybe her project or my project. We didn't know. But after Love Don't Live Here, like we were like, there's a sound. I've played this for my friends and people, and they're kind of like flipping out. Like, we have something. And that's when we, you know, decided to like, let's just start a little side project and see what happens, you know? And, you know, sometimes I think the most beautiful things can happen when you just kind of get out of your own way. And we were just having fun with it. We weren't putting any pressure on it. But early on, the first like few shows, the crowds kept building. Each, you know, 2 weeks we would go play Third and Lindsley, and we knew we were onto something, you know? And I think timing, everything's timing. You know, the town was looking for a new group. You know, we had, you know, two lead singers, you know, three-part harmony. It just felt fresh at the time.
Yeah, it's so interesting, like, using that method of playing it for friends or people that are close to you, because no matter what they say, you can tell if it interests them or not. They can go, oh, yeah, that's good, I like it. But you can hear it in the tone of their voice. But if it really is drawing them in, it's such an effective way of telling. It's really hard to tell with your own work what is interesting or not sometimes, because you're creating so much of it you can barely tell.
Exactly. I mean, with this project, I knew I loved it and it felt great, but it wasn't until I, you know, played like, you know, can't lose you for my wife or my friends or run. You know, I was just like, I don't know what this is, where this is going, but something feels really cool about this. And I played those songs and people were like, this is just cool. They're like, it doesn't sound like something Lady A could do, but like you should do this. And it just started giving me the confidence and I felt like I had a direction. I mean, one of my favorite stories to tell is Need You Now was just this little acoustic work tape we had that we recorded on our computer and it didn't sound good. We didn't have all the parts worked out. And it wasn't until I played it for a couple of people, and there was two girls in the A&R department at Capitol, and they were like, that's badass. I don't know why, but that's badass. And I remember kind of going, really? Huh. All right. Well, we'll give it a shot. You know, so you just don't know. I mean, I think the people will tell you, but, you know, obviously there's a lot of things that go with it too. I mean, things got to be marketed right and put out there. But I do believe that, you know, usually great songs find their way sometimes. I think obviously there's examples where sometimes they don't. But, you know, when all those recipes are together and they, you know, hit people, the world will tell you if it's great or not.
Yes, yes. Well, yeah, I mean, they'll certainly find their way. The one thing that doesn't happen is bad songs ever making it. You know, some good songs can get lost in the mix. But audiences are pretty... they're pretty discriminating on what they'll upvote and what they won't.
And it doesn't necessarily mean it has to be the greatest piece of lyrical art, too. I mean, I think that's something where, like, I just feel like people love to just hate on songs that just feel good. And it's like, we need that in the world, too. Sometimes music doesn't need to be, you know, every song doesn't need to be God Only Knows, you know. I mean, sometimes you need a, you know, girls just want to have fun, you know, or whatever it might be. I mean,
I was watching The Sandlot the other night with my kids. I hadn't heard the song Tequila in 10 years. And you know, the world needs a couple tequilas like that. It's the perfect song
for that song.
Dude, it's just, you know, it knocks it out of the park. Now, this record that you have coming out, we're recording this now, it's going to come out Friday. This is not your first solo endeavor. Plenty of people who had seen as much success as they did with a band like Lady A wouldn't find it, you know, necessary or even interesting to do a solo career. This has always been a part of your musical endeavor. How does it differ from the work that you do with Lady A on like a creative, on a very granular creative level? How do you work differently on the solo stuff than you do when it's a Lady A project?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, first off, it's a little more freeing in the way that I don't have to compromise on anything. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, you know, with compromise, honestly, too, in the band, it's like we always agree on where we're going to go. But like the main reason I felt like this needed to be solo was, one, sonically, I really wanted to chase down an 80s feel. And secondly, I really wanted to kind of share this story of gratitude and forgiveness and forgiving myself that I've been through in this past 3 years through my sobriety journey. You know, there's a lot of hitting on that point. And I can't go into the room and say, hey, Dave, hey, Hillary, I'd love to write a song all about my experience. And I want it to sound 80s. Yeah. Are you in? You know, so to me, it just showed itself as needing to be from a singular, you know, perspective as well. And it's just fun to create a different lane, you know, in a perfect world. I don't expect this thing to be to the success of Lady A, but if I can create a fun little lane that when I'm off the road with Lady A, it just keeps me artistic and creative. I need it so bad. And, you know, we have such good balance with the band and between families and stuff that sometimes I feel like I'm probably not making as much music as I wish I could. And this kind of helps me, you know, scratch that itch, so to speak, where I'm able to kind of create music when I want to on the side. But really, the main thing is I just felt like I needed to time stamp this point in my life with some music. And I also feel like creatively I needed to step out of the box because I've been doing this for 20 years now almost. And, you know, there's just times you're just like, I wish I could paint outside of the lines a little bit. And there are certain lines you have to kind of stay within musically in the genre of country. And I feel like I'm able to really unapologetically just go for whatever feels right, you know, on my own.
It reminds me of when a basketball player has been very successful on a certain team, but then they get traded to another one that plays stylistically different. And it's like, man, we won a bunch of championships with a big in the lane, but it's really fun to cut to the basket now that we're doing like pace and space. And you see them in press conferences afterwards, and they're all so happy afterwards. And it has nothing to do with the team that you played on before. It saw a lot of success, and it's awesome. Exactly. But it's fun to play in different styles, man. I mean, it's just on a human level. It's just fun.
Well, I mean, art, too, you know, without boundaries is kind of what it's all about. You know, it's what it should be about more. And I think all those boundaries are getting broken down with every, you know, so often. Just, you know, we're growing up in a playlist generation. Everybody loves everything, listens to everything. And I think you're seeing that. And a lot of people outside, you know, in pop world coming into the country world. And so for me, it's always been such a strong love of mine, this style of music, the 80s in particular. And I wanted to make sure I kind of gave a nod to it, but wasn't playing some kind of character, so to speak, you know, where it is authentically who I am. And so, you know, vocally I'm still sounds like the same guy. You know, I might be singing a little higher or stacking some vocals on top of myself, but it feels like my voice likes to live in this world, and I've always kind of loved that and known that and wanted to really be able to go for it. I mean, the sound of it isn't all that much different than even when we did Need You Now, you know, which I will always unapologetically say that is a pop song. Mm-hmm. Through and through, that is a pop song.
There is something happening right now with the sound of the 80s, with what's happening now. Yesterday I interviewed Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics, so I kind of...
He's a good buddy of mine.
Oh, really? Okay, there you go.
We hang out down at, in the Bahamas together. We've written some. He is an amazing dude.
He seems like such a champion. But I was revisiting their catalog, and I told him this on the interview yesterday. Like, it blew my mind how modern it all sounded. I mean, if you just heard the start of Sweet Dreams come in now before the lyrics, I mean, you could tell me that was the start of a Post Malone song or something like that was released last week. It's a trip.
Yeah, everything comes back around. I mean, it always has, you know, and it's fun to see it. I mean, even our genre, you're seeing a lot of the old traditional country come back around, and in the pop world, you're seeing all this synth, you know, getting played a lot more. Which is funny, because I was like, I've been working on this record for a couple of years now, and I was like, damn it, everybody's putting synth in. I was like, I'm not going to look so fresh anymore. But I really did, though. I think the difference is a lot of the stuff going on is really poppy, synth, and heavy. You know, I definitely wanted to make sure it sounded like it could have come out in the 80s, you know. But it obviously has some modern tricks to it. But there's a lot of really, truly trying to time stamp that time. I mean, I even had... you know, my buddy Dan Huff didn't even produce any of these tracks, but I sent him some stuff and he was like, you got to let me play guitar on some of these. Yeah. And, you know, Dan Huff was the guy that played the solos on probably half of every 80s power ballad you've ever heard. And we got that actual tone, you know, and the guy that, you know, was there. And so it did feel like there was a hint of authenticity to this project, you know, throughout the whole thing.
That reminds me of, I heard when Dan Auerbach moved to Nashville, he was asked around, he's like, I want guys around here who play like these older session players. And someone told him, like, all those older session players are still here. You can just get those guys.
All you got to do, just go get them.
That's who were some of the people that you tapped on the technical end and even on the creative end to bring that vision you had through for this project?
Well, it came out naturally. I mean, this wasn't like this idea I had and then went into the room. It came from the rooms. You know, I had written this song with Sam Ellis, who's an amazing writer, producer, and we wrote a song called Run. And I was like, that, whatever this is, feels really cool. I don't know what's going to happen with it. And so the next week I go in with Lindsey Rhymes, and I had Josh Keir in there, who I wrote Need You Now with, and Michael Whitworth. And I was like, dude, check out this song I just wrote. And I played him Run. And so all of a sudden, Lindsey goes over to the synth and starts playing those chords that end up being Can't Lose You. And so then I was like, okay, not only are these the two producers that get where I want to go, but like, this is a lot, like, this is the thing. And so from there, it was like I just kept getting in the room with those same guys, those same two producers, Sam Ellis and Lindsey Rhymes. And we started just slowly developing, you know, a project. And I think after about probably six songs, I was like, all right, this is it. This is the direction, you know? So it just kind of showed itself. And, you know, and there was conversations within that whole process of like, okay, well, if I want to put it out in the country, I'm going to have to put some steel guitar on this. And I was
sure.
like,
sure, sure.
It just feels like I'd be bastardizing the song, you know? And I was like, it doesn't need that. It doesn't want that. So I was able to just say, you know what? I'm a solo artist. I can do this. If people think I'm crazy, screw it. And I was able to just, you know, go for it. And I feel like, you know, I think that was probably the best decision I could have made, is just to make sure that I was really fully committing to making an 80s record, you know?
All the artists that are North Stars for all of us, the one thing that they have in common is they always took the audience to a place. The audience doesn't necessarily know what they want, and but if you show them something that's beautiful and compelling, audiences are smart, and they will. They've shown time and time again that they'll come along. You know.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that was, you know, I mean, that couldn't have said it better myself. I mean, you know, and I think that's what's so hard about maybe even the music business right now, is it's such a quickly consumed thing that if it doesn't grab you really quick, it's like, how would the Bob Dylans of the world have made it in today's world? Even like Bruce Springsteen, I mean, you have to kind of like listen to it. It's not like their voices just jump off the radio, but once you listen to it, you're like, I can't get enough of it. But, you know, I mean, they're not, it's not like, you know, the minute you hear Michael Jackson, you're like, that's one of the best voices I've ever heard. The minute you hear, you know, Journey, you're like, holy crap, like it's grabbing me right off the bat. But we're, you know, we're to those other types of kind of more interesting vocalists too come out without having to like soak it in a little bit. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for me, you know, there was a lot of self-discovery too, of just like, I've never gone after a project with a theme in mind and fully committed to a sound from top to bottom. And like you said, I don't know if people are, I didn't know if people were going to get it or dig it, but like sometimes you almost just got to go for it and take them on the journey and
take them there.
Show them maybe what they're missing. Maybe you're missing a little bit of this kind of throwback sound, you know, in your life.
That's the job for sure. And so you mentioned earlier, you touched on that, like one of the thematic terms on this record is your sobriety. On a technical level, working, you know, sober now, like how has that changed your creative process? What does it feel like now to create when substances aren't involved?
Yeah. Well, I think just a lot more present and a lot more effective, you know. I mean, I do think, you know, listen, a couple drinks will definitely loosen you up and sure. and you know, can help. But for me, it was never a couple drinks. At some point, you know, I'd be in the recording session and I'd be really great for a few hours. Then towards the end, you're not getting anything great, especially vocally out of me. But to me, also just more than anything, it just gave me a lyrical, so much lyrical landscape to pull from. You know, a lot of the gratitude, a lot of the, you know, forgiveness I'd been given, and a lot of just, I don't know, this kind of new, fresh lease on life. You know, and I just look at the world so much differently now. I think I've shed a lot of fear that I was holding on to for the longest time, especially fear of like what people were going to think artistically from me. And now I kind of been in this long enough and I think healed a lot through this journey of like, dude, just make music that moves you and that people will respond. And I think it's kind of showing itself slowly but surely, just even seeing the response from this project. It's like, you know, when you make some bolder decisions in your life, you know, great things can happen if it's for the right reasons. And I think this was completely made from the right headspace. And so I don't know. It's just taught me to just let go. Just create the art and then let go and see where it goes.
You know, you used a word there that I haven't heard too much when people are describing a journey like that. Usually when people are describing a sobriety journey, you'll hear like, you know, regret, making amends and this. But you use the word gratitude right there. Can you kind of dig in on that? What sort of gratitude do you feel? And why?
The people in my life that didn't give up on me. I mean, I think that's where the gratitude comes in. It's like you actually start like, I think sometimes in life you have to hit some sort of bottom to like take you to the next stage of your life and where you need to go. You know, they call it kind of the gift of desperation. You know, in a lot of the rooms I get into, and there is a gift, because it's like, it's almost like you've been hit over the head, and it's like, come on, man, like this world has much more to offer. And I don't think I would have gotten there without, you know, having become an alcoholic and hit this point. It kind of got me closer to my spirituality and all these things. So in a way, you know, it was kind of a gift that I had gotten to that point. And I know that sounds backwards, but, you know, I think that's part of the life, is like sometimes your biggest lessons are learned in failure, you know, and there's a little bit of that kind of same, I think, lesson and theme of what I've been through the past 3 years.
It's got to be particularly a difficult lesson to learn as a performer, because as a performer, there is this sort of psychological thing of like, I'm here right now in this room and I'm worth something to you because I'm entertaining. I'm worth something to you because I'm giving you these things. Well, when you hit the sort of bottom that you're talking about, the people in your life, you're just asking them, you got to love me because I'm me. I'm not at this moment, I got nothing to offer you. And maybe all I'm doing is dragging you down right now. So it had to be particularly difficult given what your job is, what your gig is.
Well, you know, luckily I never hit such a bottom that it was, you know, detrimental. And I think that was kind of the beauty too, is like being able to kind of catch it before it got too out of hand. But I was pretty close to losing a lot of things. I mean, my marriage was rocky, the band's relationship was rocky. And so, I don't know, there's just a lot of, it's hard not to feel, being on the other side of it now, gratitude that, you know, that we got through all this, you know, together, because it really did take a lot of support from people and forgiveness and patience. And so I feel grateful. And that, in the record, I wanted the record too to have this positive feel. Yeah. From top to bottom. I mean, there's a couple, you know, things where we delve into some struggles in there, but really it's, for the most part, just a really positive celebration of life and love and all those things.
Well, I regret to inform you that your break from signing CDs and vinyl has now come to an end, and you're going to have to get back into it. We really appreciate your time. Congratulations on the new record.
I'll be back to writing on these things the whole time.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you, man. We wish you all the best with the new record and the rollout. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it, buddy.
This week's show was brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. Use promo code TWS, the initials of our podcast, TWS, to get 15% off the first year of any new subscription. Charles Kelly's latest album is entitled Songs for a New Moon, available everywhere music is sold or streamed. If before we meet again, you sit down to write, please remember, an expensive drug habit is not a song, a compelling Instagram account is not a song, and most importantly, reverb is not a song. So let all that take care of itself, and for you, just keep your eye on the song.